What do today's trade numbers say about an American recovery?
And is the private sector back in business?
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles, happy Friday. I'm Steve Chiatakis.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's the midday update from Marketplace.org. It is Friday, December the 10th. Coming up, looks like the tax package that was worked out between President Obama and Republicans in Congress will pass the Senate. A test vote is set for next Monday. Also, the government reported this morning that the U.S. trade deficit narrowed. Later, how to scam the carpool lane by using your child's things.
But first, we got import and export numbers out of Washington today showing the nation's trade deficit has shrunk by 3.2% in October. Turns out these days we're shipping a lot of stuff to China and Mexico. Jill Schlesinger is editor-at-large at CBS Money Watch. She's with us, as she is every Friday, from New York. Good morning, Jill.
Good morning.
All right. What does it mean for us that the trade deficit is narrowed? What does that mean?
Well, first of all, the trade deficit is the difference between what the U.S. buys from the rest of the world and what we buy from them. What this really does show is that the U.S. exporting industry is cranking up. In fact, we're at a two-year high. And as you said, China bought a record amount of stuff from the U.S., and that's good news.
China and Mexico, too, yeah. Now, everybody says, Jill, that we are the world's consumers. All we do is buy stuff. But these numbers look like that may be changing. Should we be encouraged?
I think it's really encouraging because if the Chinese develop domestic consumption, if their people start buying more of our stuff, just imagine it could be a fantastic role reversal. All of a sudden, the U.S. cranks up manufacturing, produces stuff. We ship it over to China. They buy from us. Imagine the jobs that would be created then. And we'll look back and say, thank goodness for the Chinese consumers.
And China sure is a growing market, isn't it?
It sure is.
Absolutely.
And we'll look forward to that day.
All right. Jill Schlesinger at CBS Money Watch. Have a great weekend.
You too.
News this morning of another big deal in the works. Community Health Systems is bidding more than $3 billion for its rival Tenet Healthcare. A joint company would own almost 200 hospitals in the U.S. Now, this is just the latest big deal as companies try to take advantage of their stockpiles of cash. Let's turn to Chris Lowe. He's chief economist at FTN Financial, and he's here with me today in our New York studio. Good to see you, Chris.
Good to see you.
Well, we heard about another big deal, this healthcare deal. It seems like we hear about one of these acquisitions just about every week or more than one. Are companies really ready to start taking risks again with their money?
Well, that's a little bit of what's going on. Sure, you don't make a $3 billion acquisition if you're not willing to take any risk at all. But the other thing that's going on and has been a theme for years is controlling costs. The reason you make an acquisition like this is because there's economies of scale, and that usually means cuts are in the works.
Cuts to jobs? Is that what we're talking about?
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, what's unusual about this is that normally mergers are late cycle activity. This is the kind of thing that companies do when they've already done the big expansion in plant and equipment. They've already hired people. The job markets are tight and productivity is the only way to squeeze out growth. It's very unusual for early in the business cycle.
So we don't benefit really in terms of jobs as an economy with all of these acquisitions and mergers going on?
Well, certainly not short run, no. In fact, the sort of standard assumption is that the first thing you do in a merger is cut about 10% of the workforce. Long run, it means more productivity. It means these companies are more competitive and they'll hire. But, you know, we've been talking about long run now for 3 years.
All right. Another three-year situation, or two and a half at least. We've heard this week that AIG, the big insurance giant that was bailed out to the tune of $180 billion, has laid out a plan. And the Treasury Department may actually make a profit on the AIG bailout. And we heard that Citigroup, one of the biggest bailed out banks, is about to get itself out from under the government's wing as well. Are these financial institutions really as healthy as they seem?
Well, look, the big shock here is AIG. I don't think anybody thought at the time they would be able to pay the government back, and certainly not this quickly. However, there is still a lot of heavy lifting to do. The first thing these guys had to do was get back to where they were profitable. They now have to start selling assets so that they can, not be too big to fail, I guess.
A lot of toxic assets still left on the books. Chris Lowe, chief economist at FTN Financial, thanks for coming in and have a great weekend.
Thank you.
Congress passed major financial reform last summer with the intent of regulating banks. One of the big selling points there was a consumer financial watchdog.
That watchdog was Harvard Law professor Elizabeth Warren's idea. Warren was reportedly President Obama's choice to head the bureau. But some members of Congress and, to be sure, banks objected, saying she would come down too hard on financial institutions.
So the president instead tapped Warren to help set the bureau up. And Professor Warren is with us now from Washington. Thanks for being here.
It's a pleasure.
The Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act, boy, it's a long title, was passed back in the summer. How would you say the implementation's going?
We're getting started, starting to build all the pieces. It feels a little like building an airplane, you know, lots of complicated parts to it, but lots of possibility if we get it put together the right way.
What will be the first thing, do you think, consumers will notice as a result of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau?
Oh, I think they should already be starting to notice. We've identified our priorities as making the price of credit clear, as making the risks associated with the credit clear, and making it easy to compare one product to another. And I think what we're starting to see is some number of lenders who are starting to change their products because I think they realize that's what American families want.
Would you, do you think, had more authority to set things up had you been named the official, the full-on head of this bureau?
You know, there were always two jobs on the table. One was to be nominated to be the head, which would mean hearings and back and forth and probably something going on by sometime early next year. Or the president said in the alternative, there's a job getting started right now to get this agency going. And I said, what I'd really like to do is start making it go right now. And I haven't regretted the decision at all.
What do you tell people who say government shouldn't have its hands in this at all?
In that case, you end up in a world where people who want to offer good products can't do it because they're having to compete with those who are willing to offer products loaded with tricks and traps. That's a market that doesn't work. And the job of the government, the job of the cop on the beat is to say, hey, look, everybody's got to be willing to tell up front what the real cost is. That's what causes markets to be competitive. That's what causes them to work on behalf of middle-class families.
Professor Elizabeth Warren from Washington, D.C. Professor, thanks.
Thank you for having me.
By the way, there's an extended version of this interview at marketplace.org. You're listening to the Midday Update for Friday, the 10th day of December. I'm Steve Chiatakis in Los Angeles.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York. For the latest look at the markets, you can go to the numbers at marketplace.org. Now to the global perspective, what's happening in business and economics at the intersection of the U.S. and the rest of the world?
The number of complaints from bank customers is soaring. That's according to government regulators who say complaints will hit 80,000 this year.
Analysts say this growing anger at the nation's banks could lead to tougher rules on financial institutions. In London, tough rules could be announced as soon as today for European banks. Marketplace's Stephen Beard joins us now with more. Good morning, Stephen.
Hello, Jeremy.
So what are the Europeans doing to go after the banks now?
Well, a European regulator is outlining plans today for a crackdown, which is Europe-wide, covering all 27 EU countries, including Britain. And the rules are likely to go much further than the British rules, which are already in place. The bankers are not going to be happy. The British regulator is planning to endorse the plan and impose it within days to head off the traditional Christmas bonus jamboree.
The bonus jamboree. And how big of a cap on bonuses are we talking about?
We don't know yet, but most controversially, it's likely that there'll be a plan to limit the overall size of the bonus to a ratio with the basic salary. So the days of the bankers pocketing bonuses 50 times the size of their basic salaries could be numbered in Europe.
And what are the banks saying about this, Stephen?
Well, they're not happy. And it's not just the bankers. Stuart Fraser, a spokesman for the whole London Financial District, told me he's concerned because these rules will only apply in Europe.
We will be at a competitive disadvantage, and over a period of time, international banking operations will gravitate more towards more favourable environments.
But the curbs will almost certainly be imposed. Public anger is against bankers is unabated here, especially in Ireland, where opposition parties are calling for a 99% tax on bankers' bonuses.
That is a high tax. Marketplace's Stephen Beard in London. Stephen, have a good weekend.
And you, Jeremy.
We heard about the U.S. trade deficit today, of course, and how our country is faring in the global economy. In China, there's also word today exports reached a new high in November. Now, for that country, it sounds like good news, right? But Marketplace's China Bureau Chief Rob Schmitz reports the news may be too good.
China's exports are up a third over last year. Imports, even more. But don't celebrate yet, Beijing.
This certainly will add a lot of pressure for China to allow its currency to appreciate faster.
Economist Liu Ligong says from now on, news of good times in China will produce an international response, sort of like, we're happy you're doing so well, but there's this currency thing. U.S. lawmakers would like China to hurry up the appreciation of its currency because they say cheap Chinese exports have taken away American jobs. Economist Liu says allowing China's currency to appreciate would be good for China, too. Making the renminbi worth more may turn more Chinese into consumers, which would help balance an economy that's weighed heavily towards exports and investment. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
It's the final day of United Nations climate change talks in Cancun, Mexico. A whole lot wasn't expected from the summit. So did it deliver anything?
Marketplace's Eve Tro is there in Cancun, about to head back home, as a matter of fact, and she has a wrap-up of what's been going on. Hi, Eve.
Hi.
So will there be some sort of surprise deal out of Cancun?
Last we heard, there are some areas where everyone's ready to move forward, but there are sticking points that are blocking any major progress or even really any minor progress. Elliot Derringer is here in Cancun with the Pew Center on Global Climate Change, and he put it like this.
We have the makings of a deal, but time is running very short, and parties need to start moving from their hardline positions if within 24 hours we are going to have a deal.
All right, hardline positions. Who are the big players there, Eve?
There are sort of two big stories going with big players. More wealthy countries want every nation to sacrifice equally to slow climate change. But that's very different from the story that's embedded in UN climate law, which says industrial countries cause climate change, so they should pay first and pay more to fix it. A couple specific things to watch. The U.S. doesn't think it's fair for it to give money for climate change. If the countries that get that money, especially China, don't have to verify their progress, Japan doesn't think it's fair to lower its emissions by law if major polluters like the U.S. and China don't have to do that. So something will be signed in Cancun, Steve, but if it's not significant, then the UN process for climate change loses a lot of legitimacy.
All right. Marketplace's Eve Tro in Cancun. Eve, thanks.
Thank you.
Jeremy, in case the kids get restless and don't have access to Madden Football or Grand Theft Auto, the European Central Bank recommends another game they can play on the computer. Economia. Almost sounds like a Broadway play, doesn't it? It lets players decide what the appropriate interest rate is for three-month periods. They're going to work with crafty central bank governors and advisors and look at really neat economic advisors and indicators.
Are kids into this game,
Well,
Steve?
We're going to find out. Inflation Island, Jeremy. Users can zoom into different places there and see how things change depending upon how stable prices are. It does sound like you're trying to make something fun, right, to understand the economy around us.
Absolutely.
You can check out our website, marketplace.org, for a link to the European Games. And while you're there, check out our own Marketplace game of money management and fun, Budget Hero.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Friday, December 10th in New York. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And in Los Angeles, I'm Steve Chiotakis.
Well, believe it or not, tomorrow is 2 years since Bernie Madoff was arrested for his big Ponzi scheme. And the court-appointed trustee who's trying to recoup money lost in that scheme is up against a deadline to file complaints. So far, he's sued to recover about $32 billion worth. But some Madoff victims say they're now the target of these complaints. Marketplace's Janet Babin reports.
Trustee Irving Picard has filed last-minute lawsuits against some of the world's biggest banks. He says they should have known that Bernie Madoff was defrauding his clients. He's also filed suit against Madoff family members and more than 300 of Madoff's victims, like Brian Gerber, who says he lost millions.
He's suing us like we were criminals because he says that profits we made over the years were fictitious and amounted to more than the money we lost.
The lawsuits are called clawbacks. They were filed against Madoff customers who, over time, withdrew more money from their Madoff accounts than they put in. Attorney Barry Lacks represents about a dozen of these Madoff clients.
The trustee is not saying that these victims are somehow compliant in the fraud. So why is he prosecuting these cases?
The trustee's office did not return calls seeking comment, but it has said it won't pursue claims against Madoff clients with known hardships. In New York, I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
A new study shows video game sales were up 8% last month. The NPD Group report could be good news for gaming companies as they head into the holidays. But as Marketplace's David Gura reports, the profits may not get split evenly.
Last month, shoppers got to connect. That's not spelled how you think it is. It's K-I-N-E-C-T. The accessory for the Microsoft Xbox 360 hit the market in November, and this season it's the it gift for gamers. The Kinect is a very small box packed with motion recognition software and a 3D camera. It costs about $150. In November, Microsoft unloaded 2.5 million Kinects worldwide. That's enough to give one to every resident of Toronto, Canada. The company says it expects to sell 5 million by the end of the year. And that's a big deal for Microsoft, which for a while has been trying to catch up to its competitors. For the sixth straight month, the Xbox outsold those competitors, the Sony PlayStation 3 and the Nintendo Wii. So, what does this mean for Sony and Nintendo? Is this a zero-sum game? Analyst Arvind Bhatia with Stern AG says no.
The amount of time that people are spending playing video games has been going up.
And perhaps more importantly to Microsoft, the amount of money they're spending on them has gone up too. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
Well, the oldest nuclear power plant in the United States will shut down a decade early. Exelon's Oyster Creek plant in New Jersey will now close in 2019. As Sarah Gardner reports from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, this is a reaction to new environmental regulations.
New Jersey regulators wanted Exelon to build expensive new cooling towers at the 45-year-old plant. That way, the facility wouldn't need to draw cold water from the ocean and kill off billions of shrimp and other marine life. But Exelon said the towers would cost more than the aging plant was worth and decided it was wiser to fold rather than fight. In exchange for retiring the plant a decade early, regulators dropped demands for the new towers. Plant spokesman David Benson.
It does give the state a lot of lead-in time to look at where they're going to replace the generation. 6% of New Jersey's energy production is not insignificant.
The EPA is also proposing tougher water cooling standards for utilities and not just for nuclear plants. Morningstar analyst Travis Miller.
The impacts could range from nuclear plants closing to coal plants closing to gas plants having to be retrofitted.
But Miller says nuclear plants have higher operating and overhead costs than other kinds of power plants. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
At the Nobel Prize ceremony in Oslo, Norway today, dignitaries clapped for an empty chair. They were honoring this year's Peace Prize winner, a democracy activist who remains behind bars in China.
Well, the Nobel Prize is the subject of today's globalist quiz, and we're focusing on the developing nations called the BRIC, as in Brazil, Russia, India, and China. Stefan Richter is our quiz master, and he joins us now. Good morning, Stefan.
Good morning, Jeremy. Ready for today's quiz?
I am ready.
All right, so here's the question. How many Chinese citizens have won a Nobel Prize since these prizes were first awarded all the way back in 1901, so for well over a century? Your options are no Chinese, that's A, three Chinese, that's B, four Chinese have won Nobel Prizes, C, or D, 20 Chinese. Which one is it?
Well, I don't think it's going to be the low or the high end of that, 0 or 20. So I'm going to go with 3 Chinese.
What a wise man you are. Bingo. Right on. In addition to Liu Xiaobo, the current Nobel Prize laureate for peace, there were two who got it together in 1957 for physics. And so that makes for a total of 3. Or 4 is if you count the Dalai Lama, who got the Peace Prize in 1989. But, of course, that would not be welcome news by the Chinese.
No, indeed. All right. And who's 20, Stefan?
Well, this is a quiz about the BRIC countries, Brazil, Russia, India, and China,
right,
and the Nobels that these countries have won. And Do you have a guess which of these countries has done most over the last 100 years in terms of science, education, literature, history, universities?
Well, I feel like Brazil and India are the more developing of those three, and that Russia has been sort of developed for longer. So I will go with Russia on the 20.
Exactly right. The Russians have had 20. So the Russians take the cake on Nobel Prizes, but Brazil and India, of course, will say we rather take our GDP growth rates than Nobel Prizes, because that overall is a little better, and they'd be right to say so.
Exactly. Stefan Richter, editor-in-chief at The Globalist. You can find out more about the world at theglobalist.com. They've got new features all the time. Stefan, thanks so much.
You're very welcome. Talk to you next time.
And finally, Jeremy, someone caught for carrying out an idea that we've all had, I'm sure.
Indeed. A man in Seattle was driving in the carpool lane with a passenger. Well, it looked like he had a passenger in the car. He took his kid's stuffed doll from the Nickelodeon show Go Diego Go and strapped it into the passenger seat. The officer who pulled him over, Steve, said he noticed something was up because of Diego's huge, unblinking eyes.
Always a giveaway. Always.
Absolutely.
Always.
You got to be careful of those eyes. I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York.
I'm Steve Chiotakis in Los Angeles. Have a great weekend. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
American Public Media.